Thanks, Seth. Let me welcome you, especially if you're visiting. Great to have you with us. I'm Ben. Let me pray. Father, thank you that your Spirit, who inspired these words that have just been read to us to be recorded, this amazing story, thank you that he is here with us this morning, your Spirit. And please work by your Spirit in our lives, in our hearts. Open our ears. There's so much to learn in this story. Please help each of us to engage, to posture ourselves now as we pray, to come ready to receive from you, ready to hear from you, ready to be changed, encouraged, corrected, rebuked by your word. Please strengthen me. Please give energy to each one of us. Please do wonderful things through your word by your Spirit. In Jesus' name, amen. For whom was this the first time you heard this story, Jacob and Esau? Yeah, a few of us. It's a great story, isn't it? I mean, I think whether it's in the Bible or not, just on its own terms, it's a wonderfully dramatic story, full of emotion, full of intrigue. It's the kind of plot that you'd find in a sordid soap opera. And it's all about blessing. It's all about blessing. The word bless, blessing, blessed comes something like 28 times through the story. It's a deathbed blessing. Isaac, he's old, blind, doesn't know when he's going to die. And he's giving his kind of final blessing on his son. He wants to bless his favorite son, Esau. Rebekah has another favorite. There are two sons, Isaac, Rebekah, twin boys, Esau and Jacob. Esau's the oldest. Esau is Isaac's favorite. He wants to bless Esau. Rebekah loves Jacob. She wants to bless him. She hears Isaac's plan, and she devises a ruse. Jacob carries it out, carries out the deception, and the central scene of the story is Jacob receiving the blessing from his father, Isaac. Almost straight away, Esau returns, cries out bitterly when he realizes that this blessing has been stolen from him, and desperately pleads with his father, "Don't you have another blessing for me? Bless me too, my father." And the story ends, we didn't read it, but beginning of chapter 28, as Isaac sends Jacob away with another blessing, this time consciously, knowingly, blessing his son Jacob. It is an amazing story, and there's suspense, isn't there? We're kind of wondering as we go through, will the ruse work? You know, will Jacob be found out as Isaac questions him, touches him, smells him? Will Esau return before Jacob gets the blessing and spoil the plan? It's also a story about a family in an amazing state of dysfunction, isn't it? I mean, this is dysfunctional families are us. Husband and wife going behind each other's backs. A son deceiving his aged blind father. I mean, it's disgraceful, isn't it? Lying to him, barefaced lies. Who are you, Esau? Really? Yes. Murderous rage from Esau as he finds out what's happened. And then one of this two-child family being sent away. And it turns out, as we read on, he's away for over 20 years. Yet it's also a story of God's purposes going forward. Amazingly, God is at work in and through this highly dysfunctional family. You see, we were told back in chapter 25 that Jacob would be the son who has first place. He would be the son who actually rules over his older brother. Even before the twins were born, God announced that the older will serve the younger. And so this is a story of how, despite Isaac setting himself against God's revealed plan and purpose, and despite Rebekah and Jacob shockingly trying to deceive Isaac, God's purposes go forward. God is a God who cannot be thwarted. And God is a God who works even through the wicked actions of sinful people. And that, as we saw in the video, I think, last week that we watched, that's kind of the theme of Genesis, particularly these last chapters from 12 to 15. God is a God who works for good, even through the wicked plans and intentions of people. All that is here and more. We could do a whole character study on all the four main characters. But the thing I want to focus on this morning is the blessing. And I'm indebted to Tim Keller for his insights. See, the story speaks to us today about the significance of blessing and the means of obtaining blessing. See, blessing is something we all want, something we all seek, something we all need. But we usually go about trying to get it in the wrong way. So we've got 2 points this morning: the significance of blessing and the means of obtaining blessing. The significance of blessing. What is this blessing that everyone in the story is so fixated on? It's not just positive sentiment. You know, sometimes we talk about blessing someone, just say some nice things about them. There's more going on than that, isn't there? It's not just wishing good on someone. What Isaac says to Jacob has power in some way, and it can't be taken back. You see, he blesses Jacob, and even though it's done deceptively, when Esau comes and Isaac realizes what's happened, he says, "You know, and he will be blessed." He can't take it back. It can't be revoked. Blessing. This is kind of new to me, this way of thinking about blessing. But I think within the idea of blessing is an expression of personal affirmation and a declaration of future prosperity. It's an expression of personal affirmation and a declaration of future prosperity. Listen to what Isaac says, verse 27. "Ah, the smell of my son is like the smell of a field that the Lord has blessed." You know, there's personal affirmation. He delights in his son. And then Isaac goes on to pray for his son to enjoy prosperity and power. "May God give you an abundance of grain and wine. May nations serve you." But it's more than just a prayer, isn't it? It's a declaration. He says, "Be Lord," verse 29, "be Lord over your brothers." Now, I think in the case of Isaac, his identity as a patriarch, as the recipient of the promise of God that came to Abraham, means that what he says has particular weight. But there's something here that is generic, I think, that we can learn from. You see, spoken words have power, don't they? Spoken words have enormous power, especially maybe the words of a parent to a child. Spoken words are really significant. Words actually do something to us. They live in us. They kind of get to work in us. They change us. They shape us. Sometimes for good, sometimes for ill. Keller rewrites the old slogan, if you like. You know, "Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me." You know, what a load of rubbish. Words can deeply hurt us, can't they? So he rewrites it, "Sticks and stones can only break my bones, but words can make or break my soul." Spoken words are powerful, especially words of affirmation or condemnation. Even offhand comments affect us deeply, don't they? You know, if someone, even someone you don't know that well, compliments you, you know, it makes your day. I think Mark Twain said, "I can live for 2 months off a good compliment." But similarly, even someone you don't really know who says something critical to you, it lives with you, doesn't it? Eats away at you, probably lasts longer than 2 months. And if those offhand comments from a relative stranger affect us so deeply, what about words from someone who's really significant to us? A significant figure in our lives. Even words spoken at significant occasion, like a deathbed. You know, those kind of words, wow, they completely shape our lives. To bless someone, to truly speak words of blessing, means you need to know them. You need to really know them so that you're able to make an accurate spiritual discernment of who they are and how God is working in them, who God is calling them to be. And to bless them is then to affirm and encourage them to be who they really are. Have you ever been blessed like that? Yeah, as I said, this idea is fairly new to me, but I think back over my life, and there are two or three really significant occasions when people blessed me, you know, spoke into my life, and what they said gave new direction to my life and kind of empowered me to pursue it, to step into that direction. But integral to this idea of blessing is the personal affirmation and value that it communicates. You know, when someone says, you know, I see this in you, and I just want to encourage you, this is where God is leading you. This is the person I see him calling you to be. Not only those kind of specific content of the blessing is significant, but just the fact that someone recognizes value in you has massive significance. And that is something we all crave. It's something we all need. We don't just want general love from general people. We want significant people to say to us, you are uniquely valuable to me. We need the people we value to value us. The people we admire to admire us. You see, you can't bless yourself. You need someone outside of you to bless you. You can't say, it doesn't matter what anyone else thinks of me. All that matters is what I think of myself. The world may say I'm stupid, but I know I'm smart, so smart it is. It doesn't work, does it? You need someone who's smart to say you're smart. You need someone whose opinion you value to affirm you and bless you. And that is what I think is going on in this story. Part of what's going on. The blessing that Isaac gives, it's the blessing of the firstborn. It's the expression of his personal love and delight in his firstborn son. You know, in the society of the day, patriarchal society, that the firstborn son was uniquely valuable in the family, uniquely privileged. To be the firstborn was to be the apple of your father's eye. And that's what Jacob craved. Just put yourself in Jacob's position. We're not told much, but we are told Isaac loved Esau. Imagine growing up, two children in a family, and you know that your father doesn't love you, at least not as much as he loves your other sibling. And you crave his approval, you crave his love and affection. Jacob knew his father Isaac loved Esau more than him, and he longs for that affection. He longs for Isaac to smile on him, to dote on him. He longs for his father to value him like he values Esau. He wants to be the favored son. He longs for the blessing of the firstborn. And in a sense, that's a picture of all of us. We all long for that firstborn blessing, if you like. We don't just want general love from general people. We don't just want to be one among many who receive generic love and approval. We want to be the people of whom it said, there's no one like you. We want people that we admire to say of us, I love you more than anyone else. You're uniquely special and valuable to me. That's the significance of blessing. And it's something we all crave, we all need. Secondly, the means of obtaining blessing. Because in this story of Jacob, we have a striking picture, I think, of how most of us try to go about obtaining this blessing. Because what did Jacob do? How did he go about trying to get the blessing? He dressed up like someone else, didn't he? He dressed up like someone else. Dressed up like Esau, wore his clothes, covered himself in goat's hair. He pretended to be his brother so that he could get his father's blessing. And he had to. For him, Esau, that was the only way he could do it. He knew that he wouldn't be blessed as himself, as Jacob. You know, we're told earlier in 25, Esau was a ruddy man, a man of the open country, a hunter. He was a man's man. And Isaac had a taste for wild game, so he loved Esau, this hairy redhead. Jacob, in contrast, is presented as a bit of a mummy's boy. He's content to stay among the tents. He's a quiet guy, maybe smaller, less masculine, if you like. And so Jacob knows if he's going to receive that blessing from his father, then he's not going to get it as himself. So he dressed up. He dressed up like someone else, his brother. He tried to become someone else. He hid who he really was, lied about who he really was in order to get the blessing. And I want to suggest that's what we all do in different ways. We're trying to get blessing from other people by hiding who we really are and dressing up like someone else. We don't let people see who we really are. We don't let people see our deepest flaws and failures and weaknesses. And we pretend that we're someone else, something else. Isn't that what social media is all about? You know, Facebook, isn't it all about presenting, kind of portraying an image of yourself that will be well received? So you win admiration and like. We see someone we admire, someone who's smart or slick or rich or beautiful, and we think, if that person loved me, if that person valued me, if that person thought well of me, well, then I'd be blessed. And so we try to become the kind of person who will receive their love and admiration and good opinion. Maybe we focus a lot on external appearance, or we adopt a certain persona, or we work ourselves to the bone, all to win their admiration, all to get the blessing. Because if we get that, then we'll really live. For some of us, we're trying to live in such a way as to win our parents' approval. We can't stand the thought of our parents thinking badly of us, and so every decision we make is made in a way to make sure they approve of us. To be the person they want us to be. They expect us to be. Sometimes you can even dress yourself up as a good Christian. You know, you come to church, you engage in gospel community activities in order to present yourselves as the person who will win the good opinion of others in the church. We try and get the blessing by dressing up. Someone said to me recently that as they reflected on their life, they were beginning to realize just how much of their life had been spent trying to be someone else. Someone they were not. So much so that they didn't really know who they were. That sounds shocking, doesn't it? But I wonder if it's actually just that person being honest about reality, a reality that actually many of us live in, even if we won't admit it. As we go through life, we learn ways, don't we, of being, ways of portraying ourselves that will win approval. And the more we receive that approval, the more entrenched we become in that pretense. There's a tragic example of this, I think, in the TV drama Suits. I just want to make it clear, Corinne and I were watching this before we even knew Meghan Markle was in a relationship with Prince Harry. But there's a character in Suits called Lewis Litt, and he's seeking blessing, isn't he? His kind of supreme ambition in life is to get his name on the wall, to be a named partner in the law firm that he works for. But that's just the surface. What he really wants is the admiration of Harvey Specter. The admiration of Harvey Specter. Harvey is the person Lewis most admires, the person he most wants to be like, and he desperately wants Harvey to value him. On one occasion, I think it's in season 4, Lewis manages to secure a deal that makes Harvey think really highly of him. But then Lewis finds out that the deal involves him having to embezzle funds, risk going to jail, and put the whole law firm in jeopardy. But he's so obsessed with Harvey's opinion, that blessing, that he goes through with it. So I want to suggest, and I don't know if that rings true for you, but that in Jacob we see a picture of all of us, that the way we try and get blessing in life is by pretending to be someone we're not. But just like Jacob, it doesn't work. When we dress up as someone else, it doesn't work. Just think about Jacob at that point where Isaac's asked him and he's lied, and Isaac says, come here, and he smells him, catches the smell of Esau's clothes, and he says, verse 27, ah, the smell of my son. And finally, Jacob gets the look from his father that he's always wanted. The smile, the favor, the delight. But do you think it worked? Do you think it actually satisfied his longing for that blessing? No, of course not. Because he knew, didn't he, that smile, that favor wasn't really for him. His father wasn't delighting in him, Jacob, but in who he was pretending to be. And so it is for us. When we dress ourselves up to win blessing, it doesn't work. It's exhausting keeping up the pretense, and it doesn't work. It doesn't satisfy. What we really need is to have someone who sees us truly, sees us for who we really are, faults and all, and who still loves us and values us. So what's the moral of the story? And how do we get this blessing? One application of the story, and this is a little bit of a tangent, but one application is we need to be better parents than this. We need to be better parents than Isaac and Rebecca. You know, the favoritism that they had for the two sons was like poison in that family, wasn't it? If we're parents, we need to make sure that we bless all our children, get to know them as individuals and affirm them and value them as the unique people that they are. That's right. That is one application, I think, of this passage. There's much to learn as parents, but that's not enough. Because what about all of us who are already screwed up, you know? We've come through our childhood and we've been damaged in some way. We can't be thrown back into our families aged 41. So what's the hope for us? And what about those of us who actually received really good parenting and yet still find this unsatisfied longing and craving for blessing? You see, the need for that blessing isn't satisfied by good parenting. Good parenting's great, but it's not enough. So how can we receive a blessing that truly satisfies? Well, I said that the blessing Jacob gets is the blessing of the firstborn son. He doesn't deserve it, does he? Doesn't deserve it. In fact, he says himself, he deserves a curse. Says to his mum, you know, if I get found out deceiving my aged father, I'm going to be cursed. And she says, don't worry about it. Let the curse fall on me. He deserves a curse. There's only one person in the Bible who deserves the blessing of the firstborn. Jesus Christ is the firstborn son. For all eternity, he enjoyed the blessing of the firstborn. He knew the perfect, passionate love of his father. If you are a parent, I take it you know something of that kind of love. You know, when you have stood at your child's crib and you just kind of look in. You know, I think about Jacob, and I've stood in the middle of the night feeling sleep deprived, and yet looking at this child and my heart just aching with love for him, just full of joy for him and wanting the best for him. And I just want to wake him up and pick him up and squeeze him and eat him up. Yeah, it's just like a dim hint of the kind of love that the Father has for his son, Jesus. And yet Jesus left that firstborn blessing. Came to earth. And when he dies on the cross, he cries out, "My God, why have you abandoned me?" You know, this true Son of God, the apple of the Father's eye, is on the cross, rejected and forsaken. Galatians 3 says this: Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us. For it is written, "Cursed is everyone who is hung on a tree." He redeemed us in order that the blessing given to Abraham might come to the Gentiles through Christ Jesus. You see, Jesus kind of dressed up like us and received the curse that we deserve, the curse that Jacob deserved. Received that curse so that we might receive his blessing. Jesus clothed himself in our sin so we could be clothed in his righteousness. In a sense, Jesus is the true Rebecca. Yeah, when Rebecca says, "Don't worry about it, let the curse fall on me," well, it's like, that's what Jesus says, isn't it? We're the ones who deserve the curse, but he says, "Let the curse fall on me so you get the blessing." Jesus took the curse we deserve so we could be treated as firstborn sons, so that we could become firstborn sons. You know, Hebrews 12, it's describing the gathering in heaven, the multitude of people gathered before God, and describes it in a number of ways, but one of those ways is this is the church of the firstborn. The church of the firstborn. Just think about that. Yet, church literally means gathering, assembly. This is the assembly, a multitude of people, and they're all firstborn. How does that work? You know, you've got a family of 10 children. Only one of them is firstborn, even with triplets. One of them came out first. And yet, in God's family, we're all firstborn. We're all firstborn sons. See, we don't just get a blanket love. It's not like God says, "I love all of you." But he says to each one, "I love you. You're precious to me." It's personal. It's specific. God says to each one of us, "There's no one like you." This might be kind of doctrinally incorrect, but it's as if God says, "Jade, I love you more than anyone else." You know, I heard a story of a father who had a number of kids, and one of the kids came up to him and said, "Dad, am I your favorite?" And he thought, what I should say is, no, son, I love all of you just the same. But he didn't. He said, yes, you're my favorite. You're my favorite. And when another child came up, he said, and you're my favorite. It's kind of weird, isn't it? But that's the idea. We're all firstborn sons. We all have that privileged status, that specific, personal. You are my favorite one. Like, if there was no one else in the world, I would still love you. I'd still give my son to die for you. You don't just get caught up into the kind of blanket of love. No, my love is directed personally, specifically to you. I find this hard to accept. It's been one of the things I've prayed about a lot in the last couple of years, to know the personal love of God, to know it true for me. I know it's a struggle for Corinne as well. Let me give you two other verses that speak of this. In Galatians 2, Paul says, Galatians 2, verse 20, it's not 2 verse 20. It's somewhere. Anyway, he says that Christ loved me and gave himself for me. Anyone know where that is? Somewhere in Galatians. But Christ loved me. It's not just, I mean, John 3:16 is great. God so loved the world, he gave his son. And I'm part of the world, he loves me. But Paul says, the Son of God loved me. Gave himself for me. Verse 20 of Galatians 2. Great, thanks. Yes, the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. Thank you. In John 17, when Jesus is praying, he prays that the Father would love his people even as he loves his Son. Do you hear that? Jesus is praying that his Father would love us in the same way as he loves Jesus. Not in a kind of similar way, not something like it, but in the same way. And so, you know, when Jesus is baptized and the voice comes from heaven and the Father says, you are my Son, whom I love, my beloved Son, my firstborn Son. In you I take great delight. In you I'm well pleased. You know, this is the Father's words of blessing on his Son Jesus. If we're in Jesus, if we come to believe in him, that those are the words of blessing the Father speaks to us today, this morning. You're my Son, whom I love, my favored one, my firstborn. There's no one like you. I love you. I'm well pleased. When you have that kind of love in your life, you know, when those are the words that are working powerfully in your soul, then it changes you radically, profoundly. When you have that kind of blessing in your life, when you see Jesus giving up his firstborn blessing, taking on our curse, dressing himself up like us so that we get his blessing, when you see that love, when you know the smile and delight of the Father in your soul, you have an inner strength that galvanizes you. And you don't need to fear what other people think. And you don't need to hide. You've got nothing to prove. You don't need to pretend. You don't need to wear a mask. And you can take criticism. Yes, it still hurts, but it doesn't crush you. Because there's a deeper, louder voice of blessing in your life. And it also means you're free to really love other people. Your actions towards other people are not just trying to get something from them so that they bless you and admire you and think well of you. You can love them for their sake. Seth talked about life on life, living as family. We need this, don't we, to do that, to live as a loving community, as a real family. We need the love of the Father resonating in our souls. then we'll be free to be real with each other, honest. Then we'll be free to really love each other. And we'll be free to bless other people, to know them, to see them as the people God is calling them to be, and to encourage and affirm and empower them. How do you get that? That's what we need. How do you get it? Because it's one thing to hear, this is what, you know, Jesus loves me, this I know, because the Bible tells me so. That's one thing, but we need more than that, don't we? We need to hear it deeper and louder. Not just in our ears, in our heads, but in our hearts, in our souls. You know, Romans 8 talks about the spirits, testifying with our spirits, bearing witness to our spirits that we are children of God. That's what we need, isn't it? Not just to hear this declared, but to hear it in our spirits. You can't control it. It's the Spirit's work, but you can seek it. And I want to encourage you to pray for it, to seek it. If that's not your experience, if you don't have that kind of psychological, experiential knowledge of God's personal favor and delight, then seek it. Pray for it.